Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show today, Palau's president, Sorongil Whips Jr., defends a deal he signed with the US to resettle 75 deportees in his country.
I think the impression is that these people are somehow bad people. I want you to understand that they're third country nationals. They can't return home because there's harm's way that they'll be put into.
Also, a manhunt is underway in Vanuatu after a robbery at the national airport. And Fiji's most famous soccer player, Roy Krishna, has come home to play for Bulla FC in the OFC Pro League.
I'm just happy to be home and, of course, excited to play for my home club.
Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific, and coming to you from the traditional lands of the Pomerank people. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, in just a moment, we are hoping to speak to our reporter, Hilda Wayne, about passengers on board an Australian cruise ship that ran aground off the coast of Leh in Papua New Guinea. Some troubles there for tourists. But first, Port Moresby Airport is also experiencing its own troubles. A senior tour operator is warning that flight cancellations are turning international tourists away from PNG, despite the country's attractive destinations. Domestic passengers, including tourists, were forced to sleep on the floor of the domestic terminal after dozens of flights were cancelled last week. Janet Sios is the owner of Frangipani Car Hire and Tours in Kavieng and says the disruptions to flight schedules during peak travel time is a disservice to PNG's tourism industry.
Tourism is the greatest potential, not only for New Ireland, but for the whole country, because of our uniqueness of our people and our cultures and traditions. And people would like to come from anywhere in the world to see what we've got. And so there's been recent exposure of our culture and our tradition by many of our tourists that have come in, and the potential is there. But as you already reading about it in the social media, the airline is not supporting that development and that growth, that potential that's there.
The recent cancellation of flights and the disruptions of flights out of Port Moresby Jackson's Airport domestic terminal has really drawn a lot of reactions on Facebook. What were your thoughts when you saw, yes, especially tourists reacting to and sharing their experiences as well?
Yeah, and that is not good at this time when, you know, tourists are really looking forward to coming to our country at Christmas, especially in New Ireland. That I saw Shane from Rubio Plantation that highlighted that two of his clients missed their flight so many times, and then even one got canceled his flight and returned to his country overseas. This is not good. This is not encouraging tourism in our country. So it's a disappointment that in New Guinea, if you can cancel it is one thing, but you offload them is another thing. And these guys have paid, booked, and are looking forward to a good time in our country. And we've just let them down. And now they will have a negative reaction to us. And they will probably spread the word about the airline issues in our country. And that doesn't do any good to the tourism industry in the country. So quite disappointing that Air New Guinea, the national airline, has added 3 aircraft now, and they still continue to have disruption and cancellation. I mean, they have made commitment to grow the tourism industry themselves, but they are going against their own plans and words by disappointing such tourists that are trying to come for Christmas at this time.
Would you have a rough estimate of how much tourism brings into the PNG economy?
Yeah, I have no idea about the value of the revenue generated in Tupapu. I might have had it, but right now my mind is not on them. But I know that it's not as it's not a big contributor to the GDP of Papua New Guinea. It's a very smaller percentage of what contributes to the national purse. And so this is the situation in Papua New Guinea, whereas Fiji is probably the top, you know, three generators of revenue for the Fijian. But comparing Fiji and Ayumi, true, we got more cultures, more mountains, more rivers, more beautiful sceneries to offer the world in terms of tourism. And then once we get it right, we will be taking over the industry in the Pacific. And so Papua New Guineans, if this message is going to go to our people throughout the country and even overseas, this is the message. Potential, believe me, Papua New Guinea in tourism is a sleeping giant, is untapped. And if we can get the structure right, the infrastructure right, the planning right, the execution, both by government and even us private sector, we can get it right. We will take over in the tourism industry in the Pacific. And right now, tourism is not a big contributor to Papua New Guinea purse. We must increase it to at least 40% contributor by getting the right infrastructure, the roads, the security, law and order issue, and the hotels and the products that we offer on the market. We must get the training right.
Pacific Beat.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. And if you're just joining me this morning, we just heard from a tour operator in PNG, extremely upset about how flight delays out of the country's national airport is impacting tourism. And PNG's tourism troubles continue because passengers on board an Australian cruise ship that ran aground off the coast of Leh in PNG will be flown out of the country after efforts to refloat the Coral Adventurer have failed. The cruise ship was carrying 80 passengers and 43 crew members when it became stranded on Saturday morning. The owners of the ship say they have cancelled the passengers' trip after repeated attempts to get the vessel off a reef where it's been sitting for the past 4 days. The ABC's Hilda Wayne has been following this story and she joins me this morning out of Townsville. Good morning, Hilda.
Good morning, Jordan. Nice to be with you this morning.
Lovely to have you this morning as well. Hilda, tell me, what do we know about the passengers on the vessel after almost 4 days on the reef? What do we know about their condition?
Yeah, so Jordan, everybody's concerned, local authorities as well. And from what we have so far, the police and the maritime have put out a statement. The company also says the passengers are well. Operators of the Coral Adventure, the ship, Coral Expeditions, have told the passengers that their tour will be ending early and they're expected to be flown out of PNG on a charter flight. Now, the company says it will work with local authorities to refloat the vessel. So a lot will be happening today to ensure the ship gets, you know, off the reef and into the waters again.
Now, PNG's Maritime Safety Agency has been the one at the forefront of responding to this incident. How has the government responded to the situation?
Yes, the Maritime is aware and has been continuing with assessments as we speak, and police are providing security for all those on board. The PNG government really is taking this very seriously, obviously, because of the safety of passengers, the well-being of passengers, and also any possible damages to the ship. And I spoke to Leh MP, who is also the Deputy Prime Minister of PNG, John Rosso, who was in Leh yesterday, and this is what he had to say.
The captain tried to wait for high tide to have the boat refloated again. The first attempt couldn't make it. But we've had the National Maritime Service inspectors have already been to the site, and we have adequate police patrol boat is in the area to provide security, and they are 3 policemen on the ship itself to assist the crew and captain to ensure that all the passengers are safe and the crew are safe. So they're trying to refloat it again. And there's no hull damage or no leaks in the boat at the moment. If they can't float it, then the passengers and crew will be evacuated to Leh.
PNG Deputy Prime Minister John Rosso there. But Hilda, there's still questions over how the Coral Adventurer ended up on the reef near Leh. I understand it's a question the National Maritime Safety Administration is looking into.
Yes, definitely. The PNG Maritime has actually put out an official statement, but has not specifically mentioned why this vessel got stuck in the reef. I've tried to get in touch with the CEO, but couldn't get any response yet. However, the governor of Morobe Province, Rainbow Paita, did suggest the vessel was traveling in a route not normally used by local boats. So I've spoken to Governor Paita, and here's what he had to say.
For tourist boats, I think it'll be one of those first incidents where I think the route they took was not usually the route a lot of fishing or cruise boats usually take. But it's, a lot of our local commuters by boats and those boat operators know that the reef is very high there.
And that was the governor of Morobe Province, Rainbow Paita. And Jordan, yes, still a lot of unanswered questions, and I hope we get some of those answered today.
Yeah, I'm sure lots of people are wondering. Finally, Hilda, do we know when those passengers will be removed from the Coral Adventurer and how?
Jordan, no, we do not get have that information yet from the operators of the ship. That information has not been provided, so we will keep a close eye on how things play out today. And it's likely that they'll be brought ashore to Leh first before they will be transported to Port Moresby.
Well, Hilda, thank you very much for joining me this morning with all those updates.
Thank you, Jordan. Have a great day.
That was our reporter, Hilda Wayne, speaking to me there.
Talofa Lava, this is Sosefo Morning from Sister Sounds and On The Record, wishing you a merry and bright Christmas wherever you're celebrating across the Pacific, and all the very best for the year ahead. I can't wait to share more great music and stories with you in 2026.
What it is, Marolele, it's Haola Tukefu from In The Fale, wishing you a peaceful, joyful Christmas and a happy new year. 2025 has been full of good vibes and great tracks, and I can't wait to bring you even more music to come in 2026 on ABC Radio Australia.
Hi, this is Rick Howe from Island Music, wishing you and your loved ones a peaceful Christmas and joyful New Year. I've loved sharing the best in Pacific music with you this year, and I look forward to bringing you even more unforgettable Pacific music in 2026 on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. Now, a manhunt is underway in Port Vila today. Vanuatu police are searching for two men who carried out a daring armed robbery at the national airport. Police say the thieves made off with more than 8 million vatu, which is about 98,000 Australian dollars, after holding up a Western Union cash transport. The country's police chief has appealed to Port Vila residents to keep an eye out and report the sighting of a white minivan used in the raid. For more on this, I'm joined now by our reporter in Port Vila, Lily Rose. Well, good morning, Lily Rose.
Good morning, Jordan.
Lily Rose, what's the mood like in Port Vila following this robbery?
Well, there's widespread shock in Port Vila, as is expected. A robbery, especially in daylight in Port Vila, especially at the international airport at broad daylight is rare, and it has unsettled the community and drawn strong public attention.
Now, police have released pretty detailed information about that robbery. What exactly has the Commissioner of Police said about how it all unfolded?
In a media statement, the Police Commissioner, Kalsem Bongran, says the incident occurred just before midday yesterday when a Western Union cash transport arrived at the airport carrying foreign currency for customs processing before being shipped overseas. A white minivan stopped behind the bus. Two suspects exited the minivan. One assaulted the driver, the other armed with a firearm threatened a female officer that was accompanying the driver, allowing the other suspect to seize a suitcase of cash.
Wow. Yeah. It's like something out of a movie. Pretty incredible, but very dangerous as well. Mm-hmm. What details have the police shared about the vehicle and the suspects involved?
Well, police say there are two suspects. Whether they're male or female, that is unclear. They have not formally identified their gender. At least they said they are harmed, and the suspects flee in a white minivan with tinted windows with the registration number that is now widely circulated in Vanuatu. And they run off with a suitcase that contained more than 8 million baht to around 98,000 Australian dollars in foreign currency.
Now, I understand that amount of money is just a portion of what was being carried. Are police confident that the remaining cash is secure?
Well, according to the police commissioner, he says there were three suitcases in total and only one was taken. They confirm that the remaining cash is secure, and investigation is now focused on locating the suspects and recovering the stolen money.
And have police increased presence around Port Vila? What can the public expect over the next couple of days? Like you have said there, those suspects are armed.
Well, the police is and the public has seen a wide spread of, you know, Vanuatu Mobile Force being at checkpoints, checking all vehicles and all that. So the police can, the public can expect a heightened police Vanuatu Mobile Force presence across Port Vila, including HAMP officers. And they say, according to the police commissioner, that this was in response to and reflect the fact that the suspects are believed to be harmed. So there are armed officers around Port Vila, in particular checkpoints.
And you said before that the public is very shocked by the fact that this robbery has taken place, like you say, in broad daylight as well. What about concerns about safety? Are the public concerned about it?
They are very concerned. Like yesterday, I spoke to a couple of my friends and they had to go early, usually around 7 o'clock. Most of, you know, people are still at Nakamas and all that, but because of the concerns to public safety, which the police have urged the public to remain calm, but still, listen, the people are still uncertain. But authorities are advising people to stay alert, take extra precautions, and report any sightings of the suspect vehicle, and to report to the police if they see any minivan or any suspect that activity in private yards, to call a particular number that they have circulated widely around Vanuatu. But the manhunt is still underway and police say further updates will be provided as the situation develops.
Well, Lily Rose, I'm sure you'll keep us updated across the day with this developing story. Lily Rose Welbel, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Jordan.
That's our ABC reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Welbel.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, Palau's president, Sorongal Whips Jr., is defending a deal he signed with the US to resettle 75 deportees in his country. Mr. Whips says the third country nationals who will live and work in Palau are not criminals, but skilled workers who can boost the nation's workforce. In return, Palau will receive US$7 million for support services, infrastructure, and a new hospital. And the president has rejected claims that he acted alone, telling me earlier that a working group of chiefs, women leaders, and house leaders backed the agreement before it was signed.
Back in June of, I guess, of this year, the United States came to us with a request. So during that time, I approached the Council of Chiefs and the Congress to let them know this is a request that's been made by the United States. Because of the closeness of our relationship, I think there's an opportunity for us to work together. So let's see how we can work together. We had a meeting with the U.S. ambassador here in Palau in July. He was brought to the meeting There was lots of questions asked. And the main concern, because there was agreement in front of us, was there, you know, there was a lot of uncertainties. For example, we had seen that other countries that accept these, they had accepted these people and they had criminal records, for example. That was one of the issues that Palau was very concerned about. We didn't want any criminals coming to Palau. We didn't want to detain the people. We wanted them to be able to work. We wanted to be able to stay here. So these were issues that we had to work out with the United States to make sure that we were clear on who we would be accepting. So from that point, we had several meetings. I went to the U.S. and then Deputy Secretary Landau visited Palau in September. And during that meeting, we had members of... So just to be clear, we have a Senate and we have a House. There's two branches in our government. So we have a Council of Chiefs, but we also have a Women's Council. So at the meeting with Landau, I invited the Council of Chiefs representatives and members from both houses. At that meeting, it was discussed and to move forward, the suggestion was made that there would be a working group. Now, in the working group, we have not only members of the Council of Chiefs, we have members of the Women's Council, we have the members of the Senate, members of the House, a representative of the governors, and a representative of the state speakers. The only group that had no participation in the working group, because the president of the Senate decided he didn't want to send anybody because he was opposed. Not all senators, some of the senators. So he refused to send any representative. So when it comes to the House Speaker was there and also other members of the House. So to say that Congress is opposed is, you could say, the president of the Senate and some senators, but to say Congress is opposed is kind of out of place. You could say some Council of Chiefs members were opposed, but there was a representative there. It was Chief Nir Turon. There are 16 states in Palau. We have to understand that they're all members of the council. What we did as a working group is try to address all the issues that were brought forward. And I think in the end, what we have is an agreement that we can feel comfortable with.
And with the working group, was it a unanimous approval to move ahead with the MOUs, or was there any opposition within the working group to moving ahead?
Well, the working group were all present at the signing, except there was no representative from the Senate. And we went through the process. I think one of the things that we wanted to do from the very beginning was be as transparent as possible. I mean, there's rumors that people are already in Palau. There's nobody here yet. The process is very straightforward. Once we have the MOU, the next process is the United States will send us a list. We will choose 10 people from that list. They will come. We have them coming and, you know, they will stay at the college, on campus at the college in the dormitory. And they have basically 60 days to find employment, and that will be the process.
This particular deal includes millions of dollars for infrastructure, pensions, for the hospital, and the U.S. is Palau's biggest donor. Was it possible for Palau to say no to this deal?
Oh, absolutely, and we can even say no now. The agreement is very clear. At any time, if we want to stop, we can stop. But like I said from the beginning, it's about partnership. And this is an opportunity for us to help our closest friend and ally. In fact, we actually say we're even more than that. We're family. When it comes to the security protection of the United States, we are part of the homeland.
One of the stories, anecdotes that's often brought up around this is back in 2009, Palau had a similar scheme. There were Uyghur deportees from the US that came to Palau. That caused tension. It didn't work, and they had left by 2015. How would this be any different to that sort of system?
Those people that came before, those were Uyghurs who were caught in Afghanistan and brought to Guantanamo. The people that we're talking about are third country nationals. So these people have been living in the United States anywhere from a year to 20 years or 30 years. So they've been living in the United States for a very long time. They speak English. They are not criminals. So they were not held in prison. They weren't terrorists. So it's a very different scenario. And those Uyghurs, when they came to Palau, did not come and work. They didn't speak English, for example. So one of the things that we're making sure is that these people have skills, whether they're healthcare workers or they're teachers or they're construction workers or somebody that's working in a hotel or a restaurant. They can be any of those fields. When they come, we expect them to be able to work.
What would be the legal status? You mentioned they're foreign workers, foreign nationals. What's the legal status of these deportees that are coming to Palau?
They would be unemployment visas.
Yeah. And so that visa would be connected directly to whether they're employed in Palau?
That's correct, yeah.
And if they can't find employment, how does that impact them?
Well, we'll work with them to find them employment. There's, like I said, there's 7,000 vacancies, so they'd have to, you have to work to survive, like in any other country, so they need to get a job.
If any problems emerge, whether it's crime with these 75 deportees, any social tensions, who carries the responsibility of that? Is that Palau or is it the U.S.?
They're here. So once they come to Palau, they would be like any other person that's employed that has a problem at work. You'd have to deal with them. I mean, we have a labor department that deals with those issues. That's something that they have to work out with their employer. If not, then we'd have to find them other employment. These are, problems that you would have to deal with like any other employee that you have in Palau.
And you mentioned there, it's just 75 individuals who would arrive. And like you say, a small percentage of the foreign workers that are in Palau. Palauans have raised the concerns around whether that would put stress on things like health capacity, housing capacity, policing capacity. What guarantees have you given to the Palauan people that those local services won't be stretched because of these new individuals coming to Palau?
Once again, there's 75 of them, and we already have 7,000 foreign workers here. And so just to give you an idea, once you become a foreign worker and you're employed, your employer now has withholding tax, so you become a taxpayer, just like every other foreign worker that's here. Not only that, you're required to pay a foreign labor permit as an employer to employ that person. So that's already built into the system to mitigate any cost of having a foreign worker in Palau. But on top of that, of course, the United States was generous and said, and we give you a grant to help you in all these areas so that you have the capacity. The way we look at it is actually the U.S. has now helped us increase our capacity to address other things. For example, one of our biggest challenges is drugs coming into Palau, organized crime from Chinese syndicates. They're part of what the U.S. is going to help us with is actually personnel, boots on the ground to help us combat that. In fact, what we're going to be able to do is actually, have surge capacity, have more capacity because of the additional assistance to actually do better than what we're doing now.
Well, President Whips, those were all the questions that I had. Was there anything you wanted to add about these two MOUs and the deal with the 75 deportees?
I think the impression is that these people are somehow bad people. I want you to understand that they're third country nationals that have been living in the United States, and their biggest challenge has been they can't return home because there's some kind of harm's way that they'll be put into. So because they're unable to return home, they've been allowed to work in the United States. U.S. policy, current U.S. policy is to say, well, we can send them elsewhere, but it has to be to a safe place, just to make sure that really everybody that's coming into the United States is coming in the right way. That's their their goal. So I think the idea that we're getting these band of criminals that are come here and destroy Palau is really unfair. These are good people. They have been working. They're hardworking people that only want a good life and they want a safe life. And I think that's what Palau can offer these people. And so we look forward to welcoming them. We look forward to working with them and I think ultimately growing together.
Well, lovely. Well, President Whips, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you thoroughly going through and explaining all of that. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for the opportunity. I was listening to Radio Australia this morning, and I think one of my concerns was, and I told Loyal, was they were saying it sounded like only the president pushed through with this, and the rest of Palau was opposed to it. And I said, that is not true. The president, the 16 state governors, the 16 state speakers, which represent the legislatures in all the states. Sorry, we have a lot of government for 18,000 people, but so we're very well represented. The Council of Chiefs and the Council of Women were represented.
That was Palau's president, Sorongul Whips Jr., speaking to me there about the country's new deal with the US to resettle 75 third country nationals. This is Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. And it's been a bad year in the press for the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. More than 30,000 Pacific Islanders and Timor-Leste citizens are employed in the PALM scheme. But there's been complaints of unfair pay deductions, poor working and living conditions, and an exodus of workers. But the experience of workers hasn't been all negative. Many are sending money back to families, and it's changing lives back in the islands. But for one group of meat workers in a rural Queensland town, they're looking forward to adding some Fijian flair to this holiday season. Lucy Cooper with this report.
I really do enjoy the work here. At first it's kind of hard, but I get used to it.
That's Simeone Lunalotu from Latoka in Fiji's west.
My auntie came here 4 years ago working in the meat work, and then she encouraged me to go and apply for a PALM scheme program. And then I just go and try to apply, and then here I am. My motivation is to earn money for myself and for my family.
Joining the PALM scheme 4 years ago, he works for Tees Australia, a meatworks. His friend, Kitione Samo, also from the western side of Fiji, works there too.
I came because of my family. Things are expensive back home, and it's very tough. My mom is a provider at home. She is a market vendor, and my father is a sugarcane farmer. Yeah, so they encouraged me, why don't you try going to Australia and work? And I said, okay. And I applied for the scheme, and I got through.
Both work in Bilawila, a town in central Queensland which was thrust into the national spotlight for its Back to Billow campaign, a community effort to return the Tamil family who'd been removed from their home by immigration officials in 2018. After 4 years in detention, they were returned home, and the rural town earned a reputation for its welcoming and multicultural community.
When I first came here, when we landed, when we reached here, it was nighttime, around 8. When we went to our unit, I was surprised when there was a knock on the door. And then I looked out, there were two couples. They said, we are John and Oni. We are the leader for the Fijian community. I was so surprised. I was so happy. I was very happy when there's a Fijian community here. It feels like home.
Kitione says the local community has embraced PALM scheme workers.
I found everyone was really friendly, and they socialize with everyone. I haven't experienced any racism here in Biloela. They were all welcoming. Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it really surprised me. It really surprised me.
And with Christmas just around the corner, taro, cassava and seafood will be on the menu with the local Bilawila butcher stocking Pacific delicacies.
I'll be celebrating Christmas with the Fijian community here. We just have a few of us here, and we'll do a little celebration on Christmas.
Simeone said having such a strong Fijian community in town and attending church has made Bilawila feel like a home away from home.
We go for a walk that day, and I told my friend, I think I like this place because it's quite simple, and it's kind of like my town back at home. It's not that fancy, but it's cool. It's really nice. We are so lucky that we have some ladies, Fijian ladies, who have been here for years, and that always encourage us, call us, and remind us in some meeting. They remind us for who we are in our culture, so we don't have to forget our culture, even though we come to Australia.
Both say they haven't had any bad experiences with the scheme. Here's Kitty One again.
For me, it was a good experience, but if whenever I have any problem with them, I go directly to them. I ask them and they fix the problem and they let me know if it's been fixed.
And when asked if they could change one thing about the scheme, what would it be? They both said the length of the visa.
If there's a chance to extend this for another 3 years, that would be great.
What I would suggest is maybe if they can extend the 4 years to make it 8 or 5, more than 4, it will be good. I will go back to Fiji, maybe just rest for a while, and then I'll reapply for the scheme.
That was Fijian Palm Scheme workers Simeone Luinatolo and Kitione Samo speaking to Lucy Cooper in Bilawila.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Wide, on Polytalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. Now, 17 years after he left to pursue a professional soccer career, Fiji's most famous player, Roy Krishna, has come home to play for Bulla FC in the OFC Pro League, which kicks off next month. The national captain first turned professional in New Zealand with Wellington Phoenix and then went on to feature for 4 different sides in the Indian Super League. But now Krishna not only has the chance to play professionally for a team from his own country, but he will also put a smile on his 4-year-old daughter's face by spending more time with her. So the career of Bulla FC's marquee signing, who will wear the number 21 shirt, has turned full circle in a way that he never expected.
As a young kid growing in a football environment, you always wanted to play for a professional club. And, you know, after so long, these things has come up. And, yeah, I'm just lucky enough that I got the opportunity. And, of course, it all depends on the coach. I spoke to him. He was the one who said, you tick all the boxes, in my opinion, and I want you. So, yeah, everything for places. But I'm just happy to be home. And, of course, excited to play for my home club.
It sounds like you didn't take much persuading then to join Bulla FC.
No, actually. No, because for me, I've been away from family for a while, and just to come home, I just finished my season in India, and then I just needed a few weeks to just relax with my little one. She's growing very fast, but speaking to my family, I think it was more my little one that made the decision a bit easier, because she said that I want you around all the time. So I'm just happy to be here, and I'm just excited that, you know, we have a professional club, and I'm just happy for our local boys, because this is a great platform for them to play professional and, of course, to do well and then get a bigger club in a professional environment.
What do you think of the way that the competition has been set up? You will know as well as anybody the difficulties of playing in the Pacific and the logistics of getting teams from A to B, be they club sides or international sides. Do you think this is the best model that the Pro League has got?
For me personally, yes, I think this is a great platform, especially, you know, because I didn't know how the game's going to be held. I thought we were going to be traveling every week. But the way they came up with the plan, I think it suits all the countries really well to adapt and to train and to play. But yeah, I think whatever it is, we just need to go with it, because for us, Oceania players, this is a great opportunity. You know, no matter how it comes, we just wanted to play professional, have a taste of it. And I think the first season for every club will be challenging. But at the same time, you know, it's a privilege to play professional.
and the squad, what I'm seeing is essentially the best of what Fiji has to offer. In essence, this is almost an international side, Buller FC, isn't it? But with some overseas players coming in as well.
Yes, I think if you look at all the Oceania clubs, most of them have their international players. So, yeah, it's a national team. But, you know, with few overseas players, you know, the experience they bring, it's a lot to learn for our boys, a lot to take on board, because in professional environment, there's a lot of things you need to learn, and we need to learn faster because it's just 2 weeks away before the first game. So the training is very intense, and the boys are already complaining about the endurance running. So, you know, I just told them, this is professional. This is, you know, what needs to be done to play at the high levels. But the boys are enjoying it.
So picking up on that last point, it seems to me you have a very significant role to play here in exactly the way you've just described it, saying to these players, some of whom are quite young, that this is what being a professional is all about. You've just got to get on with it if you want to make progress in your career.
Yes, Richard, I think I've learned a lot, especially when I was in Wellington Phoenix, when I first signed. You know, I get a lot of help from our captain, Durante. And then when I went to India, you know, the style, the training style, you know, different way of training. You know, all the experience I've gained, now I come back. These Fijian boys are struggling, but I told them, you know, this is just the start. You know, it's all in your mind. You know, if you think positively, if you just keep going, you know, this will, you know, improve you in when you play the first match. If you run a lot, if you do endure, if you sleep well, if you eat right, this thing will improve you as a player. And then not just a player, as a team too. So whatever experience I've gained from abroad, now I'm trying to put on these local boys, especially, you know, the Fijian boys, to do well. So yeah, hopefully they learn which they are.
And what about your own playing career now? This is the next step, clearly. I don't get any sense that you have any intention to give up anytime soon. Will you move on to something else after the Pro League?
Look, Richard, for me, you know, I'm 38. People will say I'm on the end part of my career, which is true. But for me personally, every morning I waking up, you know, I have the energy. My body is telling me, you know, you can keep going. So yeah, it all depends on my body. And so far, I know I feel fresh, you know, every morning after double sessions. So yeah, my body is really coping up well. Now I'm with Bula FC, signed for 6 months. So I'm just going to focus on these 6 months. And whatever future holds, let's see. But right now, my full focus is on Bula FC.
And first game, Buller FC versus Vanuatu United. It's quite extraordinary to contemplate, isn't it? Even a few months ago, it's something that I don't think people thought was possible.
Yes, yes. I think everyone is excited. The whole country is excited for the first match. And we know Vanuatu players, most of them are national team players. But look, this is a different game, you know, with some foreign players. We don't know how they are. But every team is strong. We just need to focus on ourselves and just can't wait.
Roy Krishna there, set to show his Fijian teammates at Bula FC what it means to be a professional soccer player as they all count towards that historic first match against Vanuatu United in the OFC Pro League on January 17th. And Roy was talking there to reporter Richard Hewitt. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this Tuesday morning. Time to take a quick look back at our main stories today. Palau's President Soronga Whips Jr. defends a deal he signed with the US to resettle 75 deportees in his country.
I think the impression is that these people are somehow bad people. I want you to understand that they're third country nationals. They can't return home because there's harm's way that they'll be put into.
And PNG's Deputy Prime Minister says passengers stranded on a grounded Australian cruise ship will soon be moved to the city of Leh and then flown home. All those stories you can catch online. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon, 5 p.m. PNG time. But right now, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daly.